You're listening to Fascinating Ohio on All Sides, a program that features local people who lead interesting lives. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Mikey's Late Night Slice didn't start with the recipe for the perfect pizza. It started with an idea that people were hungry for a place that stayed open late, a place to stop and maybe hang out after the bar. In the 16 years since, Mikey has grown from a small shop in the short north to 9 Ohio locations. Here to share how that happened is Mikey Sabaro, owner and founder of Mikey's Late Night Slice. Welcome to All Sides.
Excited to be here.
So the idea for Mikey's Late Night Slice started all the way back in 2008 in the short north. Can you tell me where the idea came from?
You know, I would say Late Night Slice's story is the typical bootstrap story. Back in 2007-8, I had this little pedicab company that operated in the short north, and I used to, you know, take people back into their cars after the bars closed, or back to their houses, or back to whatever, you know, place they were going. And I kept hearing from people on the back of these giant tricycles, you know, hey, where's the pizza by the slice in this city? Where's the pizza by the slice in this neighborhood? And there wasn't any at the time. We had plenty of, you know, Euro carts and sausage, you know, things and street meat, but there wasn't any pizza by the slice in the short north back in 2008-ish. So I just had that idea, like, all right, well, why don't we make some? And at the time, there was this little parking lot right around between 2nd and 3rd, between like Fireproof, Bodega, that era. And they had this little lean-to, and it was about 140 square foot shack, like 7 by 20.
Okay.
And it operated as the office for a used car lot that operated in that lot from like the, you know, 70s and 80s. Since it had been closed down, it had been closed down since like the 80s. It was filled with all this trash and storage and, you know, old car lot, you know, signs and everything. Mm-hmm. And I asked my landlord if I could rent it. And he said, yeah, go ahead.
200. Why would you want it? Yeah,
exactly. That was his thing. Like, why do you want this? And I said, I want to try this pizza thing. And he said, yeah, $250 a month or something, you know, really ridiculously low like that. Mm-hmm. And I spent that summer just hauling all that stuff out, cleaning it up. Doing the painting, doing the plumbing, doing the electricity work that I thought needed to be done to open a pizza shop. And about a year later, after riding the giant tricycle and having a couple bucks left over at the end of the week, I'd have, you know, a little bit to spend on some auction equipment, you know, just the cheapest stuff I could possibly find. And then I'd have another, you know, few bucks left over, and I'd buy like an old pizza oven. And then at the end of that, it was like, all right, we got this pizza shop set up. I think I'm ready to open a pizza shop. Who knows how to make pizza? And I kind of started from there. So that was, like I said, the very textbook bootstrap story.
Wow. So what made you decide on, you know, your business is known for its New York style pizza, big pizza by the slice, or you can get a whole pizza. Why did you decide on that style?
I kind of started off as this being like the anti-Columbus pizza, because of course we all know the, you know, Columbus favorites.
Yeah, yours are not squares.
Yeah, exactly. And still one of our like things to this day is it's called no squares. Mm. And we're like, we'll cut your pizza in as many little slivers as you want, but we try to stay away from squares just because it's not that style of pizza.
Wait, so you're a Columbus guy, but you're anti-Columbus pizza.
I wouldn't say I'm anti-Columbus pizza. I just thought there was a niche that needed to be,
I see. Right. Go ahead. Yeah.
But it was, we liked it. We started making pizza the way we like to eat pizza. And that was, you know, big foldable slices that you could kind of like crush at the end of the night. And we started making these dipping sauces because my, you know, a couple of friends and I that.
Well, any good Ohioan loves a dipping sauce.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
You got to have the ranch.
Got to
have
the ranch. Got to have, you know, some other stuff.
That's a Midwesterner for you.
It is. Yeah.
So you're doing the big slices, and people can, you know, even in this little space that you were in the short north, people could get a slice or they could get a whole one, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And then the idea of staying open late, you stuck with that. Still to this day, you're open late. So your market is the people who want the food late.
Yeah, not just a clever name, as we say. we're open till way past people probably should be in bed. So, you know, 2:30, 3 o'clock. Before COVID, we were up until 4 almost every night or every morning, I guess. So we're still getting back to those hours as people's schedules adjust. But you can find us pretty – if you're up, we're pretty much open.
Yeah, if you want pizza at 2:30 in the morning, you can –
We're there.
You're the guys.
We're there, yep.
So, you know, your most recent opened location is a WOSU neighbor. We share a block here in the 15th and High District near Ohio State. And full disclosure, you have not been open very long, and I have been there a lot. You're just too close. But also, more full disclosure, I'm going to tell you that I'm a vegetarian and my husband is a vegan, and you do vegan pizza very well.
Yeah. Our vegan pizza is fantastic. Likewise with our gluten-free. They're so good. And this is coming from someone who's the exact opposite of any of those things.
You want all the meat. Yeah.
Not necessarily I'm like heavy meat, but it's just they're a really good product. So
what made you decide to offer vegan pizza? Because there's, you know, pizza as a vegetarian and vegan, my husband's a vegan. He doesn't assume a pizza place will have a vegan pizza for him.
Yeah. I would say taste trends. You know, we knew that a lot of people, our shops, they kind of mirror the neighborhoods that they're in. And we always have, you know, from our, you know, kind of humble beginnings in the Short North to some of the other locations that we've grown to around here. We like to say our locations look like the neighborhoods that they're in, from the people that work there to what people want on their pizzas. So that's just kind of a product of, you know, people asking for a vegan pizza. So, you know, when we set out to make a vegan pizza, we didn't set out to make a fancy vegan pizza, as in we didn't try to put arugula and pine nuts on it. We set out to make late night slice vegan, you know, big, foldable, crushable slices of pizza that just happened to be vegan. And I think we really like hit the nail on the head with some of our vegan stuff.
Oh, yeah. You've knocked it out of the park. Your vegan barbecue chicken pizza.
Yeah.
So good.
Yep.
And I don't know where you get your vegan cheese from, but it melts really well.
It's a really good product. Yeah. It's very melty. And we went through dozens of vegan cheeses trying to find the not only the right one, but a lot of times with like vegan food service vegan stuff, at whether it's like a fake pepperoni or like a vegan, you know, chicken product, it's hard to get. Like, it really is hard to get at a really consistent level. So not only did we have to find the right product that we wanted, we had to make sure that they could supply us for a while to do it. So it was a good year or two that we spent with this project, but I think the results are pretty awesome.
And my personal favorites are, I'm a traditionalist, your cheese with fresh basil. I love it. I'm a vegetarian. I eat cheese, so sure. I'm not, yeah. And then your mushroom garlic is so good.
Mushroom and garlic, we just... good news, we switched to a way better mushroom like this week or so. So
yeah,
it's I always say like late night slice isn't like we've never claimed to be like the best or the freshest ingredients. I always say we have the perfect ingredients for the slice we want to put out. Like some of our stuff is like the mushrooms previous were like the cheapest mushrooms you could find. Not that we were trying to save money on mushrooms. That was the exact mushroom that we wanted. Mm-hmm. It just happened to be the cheapest. Our sauce, the most expensive thing you can possibly buy. So that's what late night slice is a combination of just the perfect ingredients we want for the slice we want to put out.
So you just want it to taste the way you want it to taste.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and this is Fascinating Ohio. We're talking with Mikey Saboro, owner and founder of Mikey's Late Night Slice. And your pizzas, I mean, I named a few pizzas there that have more traditional names, but your pizzas also have very unique names. Do you have fun coming up with those names?
It might be the most fun part of my job. We have a pretty robust like Pizza of the Week program, so we're always thinking about, you know, just fun new things to come up with. And I would say the most fun we have is naming those things that we come up with.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a blast.
I can't say the names of all of your pizzas on the air. I'm not going to say the name of your pepperoni pizza. But can you tell us a few that you have coming up?
Oh, yeah. We just actually got our next two quarters figured out. We have a pickle roni pizza coming up. So a traditional like pickle pizza, but with pepperoni coming up. That's a blast. We did a kind of like a Raising Cane's last year that we're probably going to bring back, kind of like a chicken fingers and fries that was really popular. A couple other surprises. And I would just say keep an eye on our website because they change every 2 weeks or so. And we just have some awesome stuff in the pipe.
And do you do most of your business with people coming to you and getting that slice? How's delivery for you?
We deliver. We deliver, I would say, mainly through third-party apps. It's kind of a necessary evil of all restaurants at this time, which we, you know, succumb to because we have to, not that we want to. But, yeah, I would say it's only about 15% of the business.
And do you have your truck anymore? Or is it all businesses?
This is a touchy subject.
Yeah, is it?
It is.
I'm sorry.
It is. No, it's okay. I'm glad you brought it up because we are actually not in the food truck business anymore.
Mm. And I mean, that's how you started. Yeah.
It was the second thing we did. So our first location was actually smaller than a food truck. So that little guard shack or that little office building.
Right.
That was smaller than a food truck.
So tell me about your truck, because I think I read somewhere that you know, when you were opening up the location on Ohio State, you just had to decide that how much, you know, how much, like, what can you do with the people you have and the time you have? And there has, some things have to go, right?
Yeah. You know, I love the food truck business, but the food truck business, as anybody in the food truck business will tell you, it's really hard. So it's all the problems of a normal restaurant, and it's all the problems of not having a location. So you have to figure out where you're going to put your restaurant with all the restaurant problems. And then you have all the problems of a 20-year-old step van. So you have all the problems of a restaurant, and then you have all these other, you know, problems along with it. So the food truck business is really hard. Now the cost of entry is really low.
Yes.
So that's why a lot of people get into it. And it's a wonderful first step to figure out if you want to be in the food service business and if your product is right and your brand is good and everything. So it's a really good testing ground, really low, I would say low cost, low risk. But when you get to a scale, you know, kind of that like we're trying to do, it's either you put that energy into another location or you put that energy into a food truck, and it's the same amount of energy. And a lot of times it's more energy to keep that thing off.
Yeah.
keep it going. I always joke that there hasn't been anybody in Columbus that hasn't seen a late night slice food truck broken down on the side of the highway, trying its hardest to get to its destination. I love the food truck game. I'm going to miss things like Comfest and Pride and some of the, you know, things that we've been doing for 15 years. But at some point it's something that will always hold a very special place, but it had to go.
So you have 9 locations now, is that right?
Yep.
Are they all in Columbus or?
Cincinnati is our out of Columbus, correct.
Okay. And, you know, not that I'm going to make you pick your favorite child, but which location, you know, just has your heart?
I tell you, this is it's a loaded question because it is. I love all my children.
Yes.
I would say the ones that we've done recently, and we just opened 3 locations in the last couple months, and those were 2 Bridge Park, situated between the Pins and the 16-bit at Bridge Park, and then on the at Easton, kind of on the back half of Pins up there, we did a location there. And those 2 locations are just beautiful. Mm. They started off as beautiful restaurants, and when we took them over, we just put our spin on them. Likewise with OSU here. So these the three new kids are just, it's the current version
of our
vibe.
You're growing into it. And
Exactly.
Because all of your locations have really fun wall decor. I mean, you just have do you have a blast putting that together?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's my living room was a framing center for months because we did 3 locations. If you've been into one of the locations, there's lots of fun art on the walls. So, yeah, I would say these last 3 that we did, I just go in and I'm like, this is what we want to do more of.
And tell me a little bit about you have a speakeasy, you have a secret room, you have a hidden. Tell me about this.
So if you've ever wandered into our location in front of the North Market around the convention center, mm-hmm. it's our High Street and Vine Street location. There is a secret little tiki bar in the basement, and we call it our tiki-easy. And it's our approach to a not necessarily like a tiki bar with a lot of like nautical kitsch, but a tiki bar that was kind of like meshed into a lounge. Mm-hmm. So it's very like Miami blue and pink lights and red. It's just swanky and fun. Like it's just a really cool location. And you don't need a password to get in. If you know about it, you can get in when we're open. We're open, I think, every day, but it's Monday and Tuesday or something like that. But if you haven't been to the Sacred Palm, the Sacred Palm is a cool little speakeasy.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go now. So, all right. So you talked about your recent locations, Bridge Park, Easton, here on OSU's campus. Are you taking a beat for a minute, or do you have bigger plans for the future?
We're certainly licking our wounds a little bit. Mm-hmm. We like to go in these sprints, and this was probably the biggest sprint we've ever done, opening 3 locations in as many months. Mm-hmm. So we're going to spend this next, probably a couple quarters making sure those locations are running really, really well. Mm-hmm. Right now, they're still beautiful. We have awesome people. The team's fantastic. So we're going to be really, spending some time making sure that the experience is great, the food's great. You know, people are having a really good time at our pizza party. But we're not slowing down either. So, at the same time, I'm still looking for, to do 1, maybe 2, maybe even 3 if the situation is correct, in 25 and early 26.
So. All right. Well, we'll stay tuned for more Mikey's.
Please do. Please do.
Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks again for having me.
We've been talking with Mikey Saboro, the founder of Mikey's Late Night Slice. And this is Fascinating Ohio on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
In 2017, President Trump took office with an inaugural address that spoke of American carnage. In 2021, President Biden took office calling to lower the temperature and the raging fires of politics. In 2025, Trump takes office a second time. What does he say? We'll hear it. I'm Steve Inskeep. Join us for live special coverage of Inauguration Day from NPR News.
Monday morning at 11 on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Scott Tong. Panama's president is trying to stop U.S.-bound migrants from trekking through the Darien Gap. Hundreds of thousands of migrants from Venezuela and other places walk through the stretch of jungle on their way north. Troops, razor wire, deportations, Panama's efforts to close the Darien Gap. Next time, here and now.
This isn't
this
the
afternoon,
way it is.
Starting at 1 on 89.7 NPR News.
A new law gives law enforcement agencies the ability to charge up to $750 for body cam videos. This is a major change in Ohio's open records law. News organizations and the ACLU urged Governor DeWine to veto the measure. Join us on All Sides as we look at the broader implications when public records are more difficult to access. That's tomorrow on All Sides with Amy Jurevich from 10 to noon on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm Amy Jurevich. And this is Fascinating Ohio, a show where we talk to neighbors who are doing interesting, fascinating things. Creating works of art out of glass is not just for professionals. Dustin Wagner of Dayton wants it to be an accessible art form for all. He is the founder of Niminal Glass. A number of years ago, he hoped to pass his passion on to others. His space is part studio, part classroom, part performance hall. Welcome to All Sides, Dustin.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
So blowing and forming molten glass has been a part of your life for 15 years. And I looked around your website. You have an extensive repertoire. You have paperweights, one-of-a-kind cups, bowls, vases, a lot of things. What is your favorite thing to make?
Well, actually, at the moment, my favorite thing to make is glastropods. I don't have those on my website, but
tell me what that is. I don't know.
Glastropods are basically like these sort of like pod formations that are formed out of bubbles. I actually started doing them when I was 25, and just through the nature of being an artist and having to kind of like sell and work and travel, I wasn't able to stick with that product for too long. I was able to practice for like a year. And then after I opened up the studio, my number one goal was to make glastropods again, because I feel like they sort of kept me being a glassblower all these years.
So are they more like a sculpture, like an art piece rather than a functional vase?
Yeah, it's kind of a sculpture, more or less. Yeah.
Okay.
Piece.
So you use a traditional Italian technique to do your glassblowing. Can you explain that to our listeners?
Well, all glassblowing, you know, roots at like, you know, the traditional kind of formats, but I really like to use kind of unorthodox techniques as well. So I do make a lot of my own tools. I find a lot of antique tools and stuff like that, that I figure out a way to incorporate into my glass. Like my Oasis Bowl series is sculpted with like an antique tool that I just found at a thrift shop. And I was like, wow, that can help me make some glass.
And tell our listeners, so as we talk about this, if anyone wants to quickly visit your website, since we're on the radio here, and take a look at these, what's your website for them to look at them?
NiminalGlass.com.
So Niminal, spell Niminal is N-Y-M-I-N-A-L. And
yeah.
Niminal is the name of your business. Can you tell me where that name came from?
Yeah, it just kind of derives from the word minimalism. I don't know. I kind of wanted to name the glass. I didn't want to name the studio after myself. It just felt kind of weird to me. And I really wanted to give the glass a voice. And really, minimalism is just like the style that I've lived to be a glassblower for 20 years now. So living small, two knives, two forks, two spoons, two bowls, you know, so on and so forth. I'm sure you get the idea.
Mm-hmm. And your pieces are really different. They're very distinctive. You have psycho zebra bowls and vases. How do you design those?
Well, the psycho zebra pattern is kind of funny. So when I was a kid, I would watch the Discovery Channel, and I love those scenes where like the lions were taking down zebras. And this is going to sound crazy, I know, but like once they took them down and kind of like tore off a layer of that black and white skin, you see all the red, and it's like that's what I wanted to recreate. So a lot of things that I'm creating are just from like thoughts that I had when I was a kid, and yeah. I know that sounds weird.
No, so someone out there can buy a bowl and it kind of looks like a zebra, but now they can know the story behind what inspired it, the Discovery Channel.
Yeah, exactly.
And nature, specifically water, they're the inspiration behind your push bowls. They kind of look like fabric or like moving water. How do you make that?
Yeah, so for those, I actually made a tool so I can actually reach on the inside of the glass. So I do make the bowl perfect, but then right at the end, I superheat the entire body, and then I reach in with a tool and just kind of push out all those lumps and stuff like that. It's really like just for me, it's a good way to get practice in making something perfect. But then I also just want things to be disformed a little bit. I don't know if maybe that's sort of a representation of the way my mind works. I'm a little distorted, being an artist, but. It is a lot of fun. It's a good way to like take out a little bit of angst too, because like you really have to put a little muscle into it to get it kind of sculpted just right. You could also overdo it too, to the point where the piece will actually kind of collapse. So it does take some strength and control and knowing when to stop as well.
And one other one I wanted to ask you about are called gravity bowls because they literally defy gravity. They kind of tilt. Can you explain those to our listeners?
Yeah, I don't. I just, after I made a couple of them, before I actually ground the bottom to make it nice and straight, they were always kind of tilted off to the side. And I just really liked the way the juxtaposition, just how it sat. And so I was like, well, I'm just going to grind it or cold work it to just sit sideways like that. And to me, it kind of resembles sort of like a planet, kind of like floating. When they are sitting on your counter, they do seem to kind of like as you walk around them, because there's so much undulating kind of movement in the glass. They almost seem to move as you move, which I like.
Now, creating your studio, you alluded to this a moment ago, creating your studio, turning it into an arts complex was quite a journey. It gives new meaning to the phrase starving artist. Tell me about your studio creation and the sacrifices you made.
Well, really, I mean, the conception of it really started when I was like 22. So I ended up getting my third job as a glass blower. And after I got that third job, I was like, man, if I want a studio, I've got to save the money. So for about 15 years, every single piece that I sold, I put all the profits from that piece in my savings account, all leading up to the moment where I could actually buy a building. And it took about 3 to 4 years to find one in Dayton. And I was actually looking all over the Midwest because to make money, I would work for other artists, but I would also make my own work and sell it as well, and travel and do street fairs. So as I was traveling, I was like, "Oh, could I do a shop in Pittsburgh? Could I do one in Ann Arbor?" Lo and behold, there's a lot of studios there, and I happen to be living close to Dayton, and I just kind of loved it here. Everything feels like so old. And actually, during COVID is when my girlfriend and I we actually bought the building, and it took about 3 years to resurrect it from basically to the point of being condemned to now usable. So it was a really long journey, and I have to admit it kind of broke me a couple of years in,
I
just
can
so much work, effortless.
imagine. I mean, I'm amazed that you paid cash for it too, right?
Yeah, we paid cash for it.
That's impressive.
I've just always wanted to be kind of like debt free. To be an artist, especially a glass blower, it's so expensive. So to have overhanging, limbs over you all the time. It's not a fun thing to live with. I mean, to be a glass blower, the gas bill is expensive, the electric is expensive, the color, the clear glass, just all the materials. If you want to rebuild a machine, you can't just go to Lowe's and find that material. It's all made from a special company that provides that material. It's all very expensive. So it was really important to me that I walk into this debt free. And so it would just take a load off. But yeah, saved the money over 15 years, paid cash for the building, paid cash for all my equipment. It was all used, and some of it I actually got from like out of barns for free, actually, but they did have to be rebuilt. So I actually built my studio itself for about $30,000. If all the equipment that I have now was new, it'd probably be, $300,000 worth of equipment. But, just pinching pennies and finding stuff wherever I can. Even like, I do a lot of scrapping and things like that. So I was finding like gas line parts out in alleys and stuff like that. So I just collect all that material and hoard it until I need it.
You are listening to Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with Dustin Wagner. He is a glassblower and the owner of the Niminal Studio in Dayton. Now, at your studio, you offer classes, and you recommend people start out with the paperweight class. What are some of the basic things you learn in this class? So I could sign up for the class, and you would teach me how to be a glassblower?
Yeah, if you were to come into the class, I would actually teach you how to stand up and sit down with the glassblower's rod, run you through the tools. And we would do all of that before we actually gather any glass and start coloring it and shaping it and stuff like that. My teaching style, I really want you to understand the process from truly the beginning to the end. And I want you to be as much a part of it as possible. Of course, I'm there doing what's called reverse glass blowing. So I'm just making sure you're holding the tools correctly, setting you up for success and stuff like that. So a paperweight's just a good place to start because you really hit all the basic points of gathering, cooling the rod, applying your color, heating, sitting down at the bench, maybe twisting the color and stuff like that. And all of those are good steps to actually getting into blowing glass. So a step up would be like making a cup. So you use all those steps to, you know, filter it into making a cup using the tools, applying the color the same way, heating, cooling in a certain way. So it's all tied together, but starting with the paperweight is a good place to start for sure.
Do you require people who sign up for your class to start with the paperweight? Do you let someone walk in and make a bowl?
Yeah, anybody can come in here and make whatever they want. I do recommend that you start with the paperweight, and that's just out of ease, just to kind of make the process a little bit easier on me a little bit. But yeah, if you want to come in and do a bowl, a big bowl to eat salads out of every day, like I'm all for it, you know.
You also have an open house and performance part to your work. What made you decide to also make your work a performance?
Well, throughout my 20s, I was always playing music. So I was in a couple bands. And so I kind of liked that on stage feeling, you know what I mean? Although deep down, I'm a really reserved, quiet person. But like being on stage was like kind of a fun challenge for me to see if I could step outside of myself. So I decided to kind of like pull that into the glass world too, and really kind of turn it into a performance. So I'm almost like, you know, not like the TV show Blown Away, but like when I'm doing these pieces, I'm kind of telling the crowd, I'm like, listen, I've done, let's say maybe this pattern before, but I've never done it to this scale. I'll be doing something like extra big or extra long or tall or something like that. So people are really seeing me sort of like walk through all the stages of like the mechanics, like what my brain is doing and like how I'm gathering glass and how much should I gather for this size of piece. And I do wear a headset and I've got speakers. Our bleachers are actually 4 feet off the ground. So you're actually overlooking.
Wait, you installed bleachers in your studio?
Yeah, we actually bought bleachers from OSU. They had some that they were selling, so we ended up picking those up. I did have to modify them because it was a four-seater, but we needed more space to walk around. So I took off the bottom seat, took off the hardware, and actually attached the bottom seat to the back, so you actually have a backrest when you're sitting on the top.
Improved bleachers, yes.
Yeah, it's cool. And then so the bleachers are actually 4 feet off the ground because the building used to be sort of a shipping and receiving center. So there's big garage doors in the front and there's small ones in the back, and there's a step up. So the big trucks would pull in with whatever goods, and then all the small trucks would come pick up and take it all to the mom and pop shops in downtown. And yeah, so it was really cool, actually, that the whole back end of the building is raised up 4 feet to actually put the bleachers up there. And that's also where my gallery is. So when you come to the studio, you go up some stairs, then you're walking through the gallery, looking at all the lighting stuff that I do, all the different collections, and then you end at the bleachers, and then, you know, typically the demo will start.
And do you have these events often? Is it are there certain dates and times, or can people just show up and see what you do?
Right now we're doing it just once a month, open houses, and it's kind of like we're doing them at like random. Like we don't have like, you know, we're not doing it like first Friday or, you know, whatever day. It's kind of like the way my schedule falls together is when we do it, but we do give people about a month to kind of, you know, prepare for and be aware that it's going to happen on whatever date. And actually our next open house is tomorrow.
Oh, tomorrow. All right.
Yeah, it'd be really fun too.
So what are you going to make tomorrow? Do you make the same thing, or is each one different? Yeah.
Yeah. Everything is different. And it's always just sort of like leaning towards like, as far as what I want to make, I'm just making whatever I feel like I want to kind of. And I always tend to kind of want to go big. So tomorrow I'm going to be doing a roll up. So I've actually custom created all these little pieces of glass that look like teardrops. They're tiny, about an inch and a half long. Well, I group all of those together and then I fuse them and it becomes a sheet of molten glass that I can then roll onto a bubble, almost like a molten blanket. And that makes the pattern. And then from there is when I'll actually blow the piece. So I'm going to do the pattern a little more complicated, but the shape a little more traditional in style this time around. So.
And I also noticed on your website that you create custom memorial glass art that can hold the ashes of a loved one. Can you describe some of the pieces that you've made with this purpose?
Yeah, I've done all kinds of stuff. You know, paperweights, of course, hearts, pumpkins.
Do you mix the ashes in, or how you explain that?
The ashes actually get mixed in, and kind of funny enough, like the last one that I did was kind of an emotional one. I actually didn't do this for a lot of years because I didn't really want to be like the arbiter of somebody's remains, you know. But then, you know, when people come to you and they really want this and you see like how bad they want it in their eyes, it's just like I decided to like go ahead and take that step and do it. And then so I did some ladies a few months ago, and you know, I got the ashes, I got the color on and everything like that. I went in for my gather and something really remarkable kind of happened, and it really like moved me a little bit. But as soon as I dipped it into the glass, there was this like sparkle, this like, and it never happens when I gather glass just normally, but with these ashes on there, for whatever reason, there was a gleam in the glass as I was coiling it up into a ball. And it was really wild. It almost kind of gives me tears thinking about it, actually.
And what did you make? What was the end product?
That was for a pumpkin. Because the lady's sister just loved Halloween and just went like, you know, balls to the wall every year, you know, putting up skeletons and all kinds of stuff. So, you know, I think I like sticking to that route, like where I don't have this one thing that I do, but I want people to make it personal to them. And that piece was really personal, and the family really loved it. So
that's lovely. Lovely. We also saw something on your website called a desert death bloom. Can you tell me what that is?
Yeah, those are kind of an interesting sculpture. Now, you know, just like anybody who's like a painter or a drawer, I guess, I also sketch and have lots of sketchbooks. So a lot of things I sketch, but I can't quite make them yet. So for the desert death blooms, I drew those like 9 years ago, and it took me about 5 years to get to the point where I could actually make one. And the most interesting part about this 5-year journey is I never even attempted one. I just kept redrawing it over and over in my sketchbook, thinking out the process. Because as I'm drawing sort of like in a circular formation. So that's how I blow glass. And, you know, obviously we're blowing and it's becoming circular. So I'm kind of thinking out the process. So it took me about 5 years to actually kind of manifest it in my brain. And then I kind of realized how it was done, and I nailed it on the first try, and I did two. Yeah, I nailed both of them. So they're really, you know, I like to think that a lot of my work comes from what I call the inner landscape, you know, just, they're just things that I want to see exist. You know what I mean? Kind of surrealist looking stuff, more or less.
And listeners, you can learn more about it at NiminalGlass.com, or you can attend the event tomorrow in Dayton at his studio. I want to say thank you to Dustin Wagner of Dayton and founder of Niminal Glass. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Amy.
And stay with us. After the break, we're going to meet another fascinating Ohioan, a filmmaker. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. George Clooney, Ben Affleck, and Clint Eastwood are a few actors who have written, produced, and directed and starred in their own films. And while he isn't as well known as those A-list actors, Ohio native Tyson Dieston hopes to one day join their ranks. The Toledo native, who now calls Columbus home after a stint in L.A., is a local actor and filmmaker who is making his feature directorial debut with his film Fields Adrift. Tyson, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you so much, Amy. I appreciate it.
So you studied psychology at Ohio State. How did that turn into an acting career?
I don't know. good question. I liked understanding other people, I guess, is how it segues into acting. Acting is a lot about finding people's perspectives, putting yourself in their shoes, and I really enjoyed that. So that's what I think I saw in psychology, and after I finished school, I just didn't want to go into any more school, and I had two older brothers who were already out in L.A., so I kind of knew the lay of the land a little bit in terms of what a career might look like. And so I spent a year here afterwards, and then I packed everything up and drove out.
And I hear that you struck gold because you booked the first audition you ever went on. Is that true?
Yes, that is true. So I was fortunate enough to have, you know, brothers out there, so I got into a management company. Sent me out, and it was I was playing kind of a mentally handicapped person in a kind of a, you know, bizarre role.
Was it a TV show, movie?
It was a movie produced by Master P. I don't know if you remember him from
maybe.
A rapper.
Yeah.
And his son was in it. And so kind of that's how it got funded, I would suppose. So that was the first one I booked, and I think I was the last one, and it was raining, and I was late. And then the movie never got made. So,
oh
yeah, that's a lot of times how it happens.
Did I see you have an IMDb page? Did I see you were in Criminal Minds? Is that right? The TV show Criminal Minds?
Yes, yes.
What was that like?
It was exciting, fast moving. It's TV is very quick. You're moving onto scenes very quickly. They have a lot to shoot. You have about 2 weeks to shoot the whole thing. So I was lucky because I was in a lot of parts of it. I was kind of a large co-star, so I wasn't the biggest guest star, is kind of the biggest person who comes out of the show. I was there kind of throughout the 2 weeks and had about three scenes, but I was kind of in other shots throughout. So it was a good kind of foray into kind of primetime TV for me.
Criminal Minds, is that show just messes you up, man.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot like them. I mean, they kind of keep churning them out. And I wanted to shout out my dad. Happy birthday to him. It's today. And but NCIS, he loves that show. So. Kind of those similar.
Makes you think of your dad. Yeah.
Yes,
I got it. So you made your directorial debut in a feature called Fields Adrift, which had its world premiere here in Columbus in April. Can you tell us about your film?
Yeah, sure. It started quickly. I mean, I had another script. I was in Los Angeles for a long time, came back to Ohio, wanted to get something made. I had a script before that I'd written, and shelved that after COVID and various other things. So I just totally started from scratch and wrote this other script in 2 months. I was living with my grandma at the time, my parents' place, and she had passed, and a family friend had passed 10 years earlier on the anniversary from glioblastoma, which is what this character has. So I kind of had these existential thoughts going in my mind, and I also wanted to create something that was very simple and a very simple story that has big ideas, but something that I could shoot. So it was very economical of how I wrote it, because the previous one, it was bigger in scope, and I realized getting funding is not easy. So
so Fields Adrift is about a man. He's 36 years old, and he finds out he has a terminal cancer, brain cancer. And so he moves back home with his parents for kind of like his final days. Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask you if that was based on someone you knew, or where did that idea come from?
Yeah, I had a family friend, and she had that. And so that was kind of, you know, I wanted something to explore, I guess, the ephemeral lives that we have, you know, and that it can happen to anyone, that it's not about old age, really. It's just everyone living our lives, and we don't know when our ends, you know, may come. And not trying to look at it bleakly. That was kind of the angle I went about for having glioblastoma, because she was a babysitter for us and a dear friend. And so the 10th anniversary had happened kind of in that same time when I started. I was like, okay, this might be an idea, a way to kind of broach the subject of this using that. impetus.
And the character in the movie, he kind of takes too many pills of one kind or of some sort, and it causes him to go on like kind of an existential journey of figuring out what it means to die.
Yeah, it's psilocybin. So it's magic mushrooms is the quote-unquote what it's actually what he takes. And the reason I did that, one, is because it is being tested for palliative care, end-of-life care. And so it is being used as a tool in order for acceptance, in order to kind of slow down everything and be able to look at it head-on. And there's a lot of studies, as in Ohio State right now has a psychedemia program. That they're studying.
So you're using your psychology degree.
See,
a little bit.
There you go. Yeah, tying it in. So yeah, I mean, I wanted it to be not that it's just like, I didn't want it to be this sort of thing haphazardly, just chucking a bunch of pills and like, oh, doing drugs. It's not about that. You know, it's about self exploration, and it also uses that I can sort of distort time. I used a lot of physics in kind of this story. So it was a way to exploit time, space. And to get around in the story, because I use that he can kind of transport because he's in this other world, basically.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides, and we're talking with local filmmaker Tyson D'Estin. And you filmed it locally in New Albany. I recognize some of those white fences.
Nice,
right?
Yes.
Yes. How did you find a film crew locally here?
I did.
You?
Yeah. I basically started out with my DP, Jack Miller, who I had found on, it's called a website production hub, and I'd used it in LA to try to get things going, so basically a nationwide. And I just thought, you know, I need someone to shoot it, and that's kind of where I started with. So I found him. I was actually going to do a short that I had contacted him about earlier. He couldn't do it, and so he came up again for this feature. And then I found the lead actor, and kind of with those two pieces, I was like, okay, I got two people behind me. I got my parents. I got a house. You know,
yeah.
Let's make a movie.
Your parents play the main character's parents in the film.
Yes.
Right? And you filmed it in their house.
Yes.
And that'll cut down on the cost. Right?
Yes, it will. That's a third of the budget.
Yes.
So yeah, that helped a lot. You know, having less locations. There's only that location and another interior at a restaurant, and the rest is just outside, which creates its own challenges, especially for this story because it's supposed to take place mainly in one day, so I'm dealing with a lot of time and light issues.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, most of it was just guerrilla, is what they say. You're just going around town and shooting things and using exterior and in the elements.
And let's listen to a clip from the movie. So earlier on in the film, Josh, the main character, meets a waitress at a restaurant, and they have a connection. In this scene, he runs into that same woman in a cornfield. And she's probably a figment of his imagination, but they have this conversation.
This isn't the way it is.
What are you talking about?
That there's something we can do, that you're wrong.
I'm not.
That I could offer you protection.
You can't.
Why not?
Because I'm dying. I'm dying. Don't you understand?
No. No, you're not.
Yes, I am. I'm dying. I am dying. Please believe me.
How do you know?
Because I know. I know. I know.
You know what?
So in that scene, it seems like your character is unsure about dying. He's trying to convince himself that it's true.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, she definitely is a figment of his imagination. I you know, granted, the movie is kind of esoteric, and I understand that, so it's a little hard to follow, I guess. But in this case, yeah, she's a figment of his imagination, and she shows up, and, you know, this is him convincing himself, trying to convince himself, of love, you know, and still finding that, and being able to find that no matter what your point in your life it is. In following that. So yeah, later on in the story, she kind of explains why you kind of came by, you know, saying like, why did your figment bring me here? And that was the reason. I think, you know, he wants to have this moment of someone convincing him. We convince ourselves a lot of things. And she was a device for that.
Now, what do you, you made this film, you wrote it, you directed it, you star in it. What do you, you, do you shop it around for film festivals? What tell me about how you get a film out there to get
it
seen.
Yeah, absolutely. There's kind of a traditional route. I more or less went that. So you finish with the film and then you do film festivals. So yeah, I premiered it at Cinema Columbus and that was great. And you go to as many other ones as you can. And depending on who's there and what type of festival, you can run into people who can help you distribute, different agents for various different things. And so I've kind of did the festival run, and now I'm at the point where I'm doing self-distribution. So I'm just starting that right now. And that's it's a whole other thing. So yeah, there's basically streaming. I mean, you can do theatrical release, but that's really tough. You know, you kind of need the bigger budget Hollywood movies to do that sort of thing. So for me, yeah, I have a friend in LA who works with Tubi, which is a streaming platform, and he's starting his own kind of platform. So there's Amazon Prime, there's Apple and Netflix. Those are tough to get onto, like the Netflix and Apple. Amazon Prime, you can just get on yourself.
So if listeners watch your film there yet or not yet?
Not yet. So I'm doing this whole social media campaign to lead up to it, which is mind-boggling because I've never done social media. I joined Facebook, and I'm a, you know, same graduating year as Mark Zuckerberg.
And you joined Facebook to
I
for
joined
this movie
3 months ago. Yes.
Oh wow.
Yes.
Late bloomer.
Yeah, just terrible. But I just didn't love it, and I still don't love it. But I have to give you know, full push of promoting this thing. You know, mm-hmm. that is part of it. I don't love it, but it is part of it. And so yeah, I'm making a push with that, and then I'll have a link at the end of this thing. Hopefully it's enticing enough and people can click on the link and watch it. Yeah.
So the film won Best Feature at the Maumee Film Festival. That's a suburb of Toledo. And also you won Best Actor at the Culver City Film Festival. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you so much.
So yeah, what was that like to tell me about starring in a movie that you're also directing? How do
yeah.
you, I mean, you're directing yourself.
Terrifying. Just, I had no idea what I was doing. I know, of course, not true, but yes, it was terrifying. That is true. But I had experience doing a play where I directed it. I was in every scene. That helped a lot. I've obviously done acting for a long time. I've been on sets. But I couldn't find a director. And so, you know, this whole thing was kind of just stumbling forward. And I knew the story well enough. I had written it, obviously, knew the character. So I just figured, okay, I will just kind of roll with it and figure it out as I go, and fortunately it worked out. But yeah, so I had a lot of trust, in my sound, Chris Cope, and my other actors and my DP. So
tell me about directing your parents.
That was fun.
We'll say happy birthday to your dad.
Yes, again.
And then
yes.
you can tell me about how you had to correct him. Like,
yes, happy
that was
birthday,
great.
Dad.
That was great, Dad, but let's do it again.
Yeah. You know, there was so little time, and I kept telling them, you know, you guys got to know this. And they've been around us for a long time, so they know how it works. But yeah, it's a different thing when you're actually doing it yourself. And they realize that, you know, like having lines and having to look this way and being kind of very mechanical in a lot of ways, which people don't realize about acting. And so, yeah, it was difficult, you know, just having them learn the lines and do different takes and then like, oh, we're done with this, but we have to do a different setup. And they're not like, sure, you know, so, but it was obviously great. Like, I'm so fortunate to have them, for them, you know, to shoot in the house. And it was a wonderful experience. So
supportive parents.
Yeah, absolutely.
And your character in the film, they're supportive parents.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're
yes.
playing themselves.
Yes, I obviously stole a lot from my life and threw in a couple other things.
Did you edit the movie too?
Yeah, yeah.
How long did that take?
8 months.
Wow.
Yeah, it was hard. I'm that's the least talent that I have is editing, so I hope to never do that again.
So you did film it. I mean, it seemed like when I was watching it that you filmed it over several seasons, but that's not true. Like, the cornfield kind of was died, but how did you do that?
Yeah, no, I shot it in 19 days over the fall. I wanted to this is very much an Ohio story. I wanted to highlight that and use just the brilliant color. So I tried to, as much as I could, to have as many leaves in the changing of colors. But then there's just one scene in the winter, yeah, that he goes back and he's at these cornfields which things change, and it's not what he thought it was anymore. So it was just one day that I dragged my whole crew out to the middle of a cornfield, and it was very cold and awful, and thank you, everyone, for that.
So you did most of the scenes you did in the 19 days, and then you just waited for it to be winter.
Yeah, I ended mid-late October and then waited a couple months to get really cold to make everyone suffer for one day in the winter, yeah.
So we only have about a minute left, but why don't you tell people what they can do to help you as a Columbus resident here? You're from New Albany. How do they help you with your film?
Oh, I don't know. I think we all help ourselves. Mm-hmm. Just being excitement, and that's what I'm trying to do. You know, I think we all have to just, if you're excited about it, Cinema Columbus, starting there, the Film Commission. You know, there's a lot of exciting things. There's a studio called Fallback Studios, which is being built in Dublin. So there is already that momentum going. So I think, just keep on in making things, you know.
Support the film scene here in Columbus.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, tell me about, just in 30 seconds, sure. Tell me about the studio in Dublin.
I don't know too much about it, but it's supposed to be opening, I think, in July, June, something like that.
Yeah, the soundstage in Dublin, they hope to have up and running in June of 2025. So Ohio's is making its way in the film industry.
Yeah, that is a huge deal to have an actual studio. A lot of things shoot in Cleveland and Cincinnati. It's kind of the backdrop is better, I think, for that. But Columbus is growing so much, so exponentially. There's so many people here and this kind of fervor that's happening. So, you know, this is a pretty big deal.
That was local actor and filmmaker Tyson Diestin, and his film is called Fields Adrift. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Amy. I appreciate it.
And this has been Fascinating Ohio on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.